your Zen Triple J mornings. And on a Thursday, we invite Dr. Carl into the studio to hang out and learn you some stuff. Well, educate you.
We're doing some darn good learning today.
Yeah, that's right. Learn you good. That's right. And last week was a really massive science hour. For anybody who missed out on it, who had their head in the sand, we had Jamie and Adam from Mythbusters in for the whole hour. They ate Weet-Bix live on air. They told lots of great stories and they answered a heap of your questions. Pretty much every question we put to them, they're like, oh, yeah, we've done that experiment.
They're very good.
It was very fun.
I was especially impressed by Jamie's elegant solution to popping a tail shaft off a car, and he was so happy that I used the word elegant because that means using the minimum amount of material in the intellectually most satisfying way.
I was especially impressed by the bromance going on in front of me between three nerds who love science. If you did miss out on it, a few people saying, where can I listen to it? That and every other science podcast is available if you missed it. triplej.net.au is the place to go. Just click on podcasts. You can subscribe. It's also there at the mornings page, triplej.net.au/mornings in a SoundCloud file. Or you can just subscribe to the podcast every week and you'll get Dr. Carl and whoever joins us delivered straight to you. It's there in iTunes, very easily found. You have some catching up and some education to share with us first before we jump into TalkBack. Some answers for us, Carl.
Yes. Number one, my answers today might be a little bit disconnected because I was up till 1:30 this morning finishing off book number 36.
Put it away.
Number one. Number two, Facebook thinks that my daughter Alice is pregnant.
How so?
Well, she has applied for and got a job at an Australian company that makes clothes. And specifically, she is now a designer in baby wear.
Ah.
Every advertisement that pops up on Facebook and Google
targeted
and Gmail is, hi, you want to buy some minerals? This thing's, hey, you're just pregnant. You want to buy some minerals? And how about some nice creams for your tummy as it expands? Okay, that's number two. Number three, the answer to lightning when it hits water. Lovely answer from Don Donaldson, which means Don, son of Don. And he says...
Don squared.
Relighting and fish, JJ Thursdays, was in Thailand in 1996. Lightning hit near the boat. Now, what we've got here is what they call in the intelligence trade ground truth.
Okay.
Right? People underwater were okay but had sore ears. People on the surface were injured.
Ah.
Now, darn it, we didn't have enough people sort of at 1 meter distances from where the lightning strike would be so we could tell who died, who was made permanently paralyzed, et cetera, which is probably good. So we do know that lightning can cause injuries. And then finally, number four, insects on a barbed wire fence.
Yeah, this was a bizarre one. So we're talking about tiny little insects getting speared on a barbed wire fence.
And just trying to make it up from the top of my head and going back to basic principles, I was thinking, surely insects would know enough not to fly into a barbed wire fence. Maybe the wind, the turbulence could have got them. Don't know, out of my depth. And then we had an answer from Vincent saying, and this is about a year ago. Sorry, Vincent, I've been a bit late. Overseas, there are creatures called shrikes, S-H-R-I-K-E, a shrike, a bird. Mm. And what they'll do is they'll get an insect and then impale it onto a thorn. Or now that we've put barbed wire fences everywhere, barbed wire. By the way, I did go to the Barbed Wire Museum in Texas.
Yeah.
As they pronounce it, Bob Wire. To support the victim, the insect, while the insect is being eaten, or to store it from later, or to attract mates. Hey, Zan, I've got a really nice bee stuck.
That's torture. They're storing the insect for later and spearing it on a barbed wire fence.
We need to get the nanny state involved to talk. But in Australia, we do not have shrikes, but we do have what's called the butcher bird, which is just simply an Australian magpie, which belongs to the same genus Cracticus. Thank you very much, Dr. Vincent. So if you see insects on a barbed wire fence, almost certainly it was an Australian magpie storing it there for later to attract a mate, to eat it later, or to be able to eat it more easily.
And not just their bad sense of direction. Very interesting stuff. Thanks so much. And hopefully everyone who asked those questions originally heard it. And if you know your mate asked them, tell them to download the podcast if they're not listening. We're going to jump into your live questions right now, 1-300-055-536, and head to Adelaide where Zach's on the phone. Hi, Zach.
Dr. Zan, Dr. Cal, how are we?
Dr. Very Zach, very good. Well. What's your question?
I'm just wondering, I work in a fairly large warehouse, and in the winter my radio seems to be loud to the point where it almost gives me a headache, whereas in the summer it seems that it's not loud enough. I was just wondering, has that got anything to do with the air density being winter and moist air or anything like that? I'm not sure why.
Ooh. definitely density of what the sound wave is travelling through affects how much energy gets the far end.
Yep.
I can't think that the temperature or humidity would make a significant difference. There's something else going on. The way around it would be firstly to get, and you'd probably have to go to your local electrical supply place, a sound level meter of some sort. It's basically a microphone with a bit of extra money, a bit of extra smart, and it'll say that's 10 dB, 20 dB, oh yeah, 60 dB, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can find out just how loud it is in summer and winter. And then if it's the same level, then there's something happening inside you. Right?
Yep.
That's the way I would go to get more information.
Yep.
Sorry about that, Zach. I've set you down a pathway of having to buy a sound, what is it, pressure sound level meter, something like that.
Hey, thanks for the call, Zach.
Anyway.
Oh, good work. Thanks so much for the call.
Thanks,
let's head to Bobby calling in from Hastings this morning. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, guys. How are you going?
Great. What's your question?
Thank you. A couple of weeks ago, I was sitting at home after having a party, and my sister-in-law was here, and I was cleaning up, and I was just using my garden variety sink sponge that I use for doing my dishes. I was wiping down my bench with it all, and my sister-in-law, oh, you can't do that. You're spreading E. coli everywhere. Am I?
only if the E. coli came near your bottom.
Oh.
Which is unusual. Or if having gone to the bathroom, you didn't wash your hands.
No.
So E. coli exist everywhere, but traditionally, they're mostly found in your gut. And so when people are looking for traces of fecal spreading, so in the ocean, they'll look for what they call coliforms. In other words, bacteria that look like E. coli. So there could be E. coli, but it's highly unlikely. With regard to the sponge, I've gone down the pathway of going for the round tissue paper, otherwise known as the toilet paper, which has never been in the toilet. And so it's a cheap source of disposable paper. Now, on one hand, it's wasteful, but that's what entropy is all about. To create a small amount of order, you have to create a larger amount of disorder. Think about a newborn baby. You've got a newborn baby, 1 year old. They're fantastic. They're beautiful. They smell delicious. In your mind's eye, imagine the pile of pooey nappies. Right. Okay. The amount of breast milk that had to go into it, 1.5 times the body weight of the mother, et cetera, et cetera. So I use tissue paper and throw it away. With sponges, I still use sponges occasionally, but every now and then I chuck them in the nuka, the microwave oven. And you've got to tune it. So if you give it too long, suddenly you've got yourself burning sponge. So you just sort of crank it up, 10 seconds, 15, 20. And what you want to do is, when the sponge is wet, get it to be able to go to the point of boiling and no more. And so that will, and that of itself will then kill the bacteria. So you put it on a plate, you put it in a nuke, you take it out, and you've heated up to 100 degrees centigrade, all the bacteria are dead.
Wow. There you go.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Bobby.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Bobby.
Also, a few people on the text line saying, regarding Zach, who when you were saying needed a dB meter, he can actually just get that as an iPhone app or a smartphone app. So there you go.
What a world we live in.
You don't have to go out and buy it. You can just download it. We are talking science, and we'd love to hear from you. Don't forget as well, if you want to get through to Dr. Carl with an answer or a comment, you can tweet him direct at Dr. Carl or text us on 0439 757 555. Let's head to Sydney now. Robert's on the phone. Hey, Robert.
G'day, Dr. Zan and Dr. Carl. How are you today?
Very good,
Dr. Robert. Dr. Robert. What's your question?
Good. Look, it's very interesting, but would like to know. I want to know what the atmospheric anomaly is that causes campfire smoke to always follow you around, no matter what side you sit on.
Ah, right. Okay. I was once doing a stage show and they had a lot of that foggy stuff on the stage.
Like the dry ice stuff.
Yeah, and it was astonishing that as you walked through it, it would come behind you. You could see it coming behind you.
Yep.
And so if you walk through it quickly, I got somebody to walk through it quickly, I could see the air coming around behind them and then building a trail. So there was a sort of a low-pressure zone behind them, if you like, a sort of semi-vacuum.
Like a vacuum, yeah.
Yeah. So in the same way, if it turns out that you're around a campfire and there's just bugger all smoke, bugger all wind, you know, for our overseas listeners, that means a microscopic amount of wind. If there's bugger all wind, but it just happens to be going onto you, the smoke, if you move to another place, you will create so much disturbance in the air that it will overpower that microscopic wind. And following the law of maximum inconvenience, Wherever you go, the smoke will follow you. The only way around is have a ground sheet and then drop to the floor, to the ground, and then crawl on that.
Under the smoke.
Crawl on the ground sheet to somewhere else and then pop up there.
See, fittingly, like that song we just played, I thought it were, you know, that was called Is There a Ghost? I just thought it was ghosts.
Or number two is ghosts. And number three, it's proof that the zombies are out there and are going to eat our souls.
Yeah, that too. Thanks for the call, Robert.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you,
let's
Dr. Robert.
Head to Brisbane. We have Lee on the line, 10 years old. Good morning, Lee.
Hello.
Are you off school at the moment?
No, I'm homeschooling.
Oh, nice. Okay, well, hopefully Dr. Carl can educate you some more. What's your question?
I know that it's possible to travel forwards in time in a couple of seconds if you're in a very fast plane. Is that possible? Can you do that backwards, like go backwards in time a couple of seconds?
Okay, well, firstly, with regard to time, we're all travelling in forward in time at the rate of 1 second per second. However, because we're here on the surface of the Earth, we're here in a gravitational well, and for us, time is going just a little bit slower than if we were way out in space, away from any major gravitational body. If you go into an aeroplane, your time will slow down. The experiment has been done back in the 70s with two of the then newly invented atomic clocks. One they just left at the airport. The other one they put into first class and sent it around the world. And when they came back, they were slightly different. The one that had gone around had gone a bit slower. So we can slow down time by going fast. And the faster you go, the more time slows down. If you're travelling in an aeroplane, you want to slow another sort of time, like the time of the sun. Well, if you're at the equator and you're in an aeroplane going 1,600 kilometres per hour, and none of the passenger planes do that anymore. There used to be the Concorde, which would do 2,200. You could actually fly somewhere and land before you took off by the local time. And so 1,600 kilometres at the equator, virtually zero at the pole, and somewhere in between, probably the number of degrees in latitude multiplied by the cos multiplied by 1,600 kilometres per hour. Play the podcast back and then work it out that way.
I was going to say, Lee, if you need to get your head around that, as I think I do, download the podcast and listen again. Hopefully it will make sense after a couple of listens.
No,
thanks for the call, Lee.
Thank you, Dr. Lee.
Bye. Let's go to Wallen now. Jacob's on the line. Hey, Jacob.
Morning, doctors. How are we?
Very well. What's your question?
I've got a question. When I cough and I sneeze too hard, like if I have a coughing fit, I start to see like black spots in my eyes to the point where my vision is pretty much impaired and I can't see anything else.
How impaired?
I can't focus and I can't read words.
For how long?
About 10 minutes.
10 minutes?
Yeah.
Do you have little black spots or scotomas? How's that for a crossword word? S-C-O-T-O-M-A. Do you have little black spots or in your vision?
They're like little black spots and like little lights, balls of light, like if you looked at a welding rod for too long and it was going off.
Ah, and this is overlaid over your general vision, which is also out of focus.
Yes.
And are you a smoker?
Yes.
How many a day?
Between 10 and 12.
This is God's way of telling you to stop smoking.
Okay.
You should stop smoking. Do you know that by the time you get to 50, you've got a 50% chance of being impotent?
Yes.
Happy to do that? Miss out on sex after you're 50? I'm laying it on you.
This is an intervention going on live on radio.
Okay, getting back to your question. In your retina, there are molecules called 11, then hyphen, Cis, C-I-S, hyphen, retinal, R-E-T-I-N-A-L. And retinal is not an adjective of retina, it's the name of the chemical, 11 cis retinal. And when a photon of light or a pressure wave transmitted through your chest into your skull and into your eyeball, when a pressure wave comes up or a photon of light, it'll hit this fragile molecule. And the molecule will change shape and turn into 11 trans, T-R-A-N-S, retinal, and give off electricity, so that's why you're getting these flashes of light. I do not understand the black spots. It could be that you're coughing so much that you're affecting the optic nerve, which is really bad. It could be that you're coughing so much that the lack of focus is due to the pressure wave pressing or changing the lens. In your eye, you've got two systems for bending light. You have the cornea at the front, and it has a bending power of about, I think it's 40, 45 diopters, and your lens has a variable or adjustable bending power of 0 to 15, and by coughing, you're doing something to one of those. If you're coughing that much, that's really bad. I would suggest you go to see your doctor and head down the pathway of giving up smoking. If it's doing that to you already, you could be uniquely sensitive. And by the way, having sex is still good.
Thanks so much for the call, Jacob.
Thank you.
We got a text in from Adrian in Melbourne as well on 0439757555 saying, I smoke roughly 20 a day and I have the same thing happen. Maybe it's time to give up.
Yes.
Maybe it is. Cassandra is calling in from Newcastle today. Hi, Cassandra. Can you just turn down the radio? Awesome. What's your question?
I just want to know, you can transplant pretty much every other organ. Why can't the intestines be transplanted?
Well, Dr. Cassandra, firstly, when you look in the morning in the mirror and you see yourself, you're only seeing 10%. Only 10% of the cells in your body have your DNA. Only 10%. 90% of the cells in your body are invaders. They're bacteria. They got in there early on, just shortly after you were born, and the majority of them live in your gut. Now, they're 90% of the cells in your body, but they don't make up 90% of your weight because they're very small cells. They are uniquely tied to you, and they make up part of your immune system. We didn't even know about them 20 years ago. You need them. There are other problems with transplanting gut. I wasn't entirely sure you couldn't transplant any of the gut, but normally, I haven't thought about this, but I think it'd be probably the fact that there's a very fine blood supply, very tricky nerve supply. For example, you have a brain in your skull, another brain in your spine, and you have another brain in your gut. Have you heard of the chemical called serotonin?
Yeah.
Right, that's very important in running the body. How about this for something surprising? 95% of your serotonin is made by the brain in your gut, not the brain in your skull. So there's all sorts of complicated stuff in your gut. It is not just a pipe made of polystyrene that food goes through and comes out the other end. So I'm not too sure why you can't transplant it. I'd easily believe that that is the case, simply because it is so intimately involved with whom you are, including being part of your immune system. And that would be the main thing stopping fire rejection.
That's a good question. Thanks so much for the call, Cassandra.
Thank you, Cassandra.
Thank you.
And we're going to head to Geelong now. Zoe is 7 years old and joins us on the phone. Hi, Zoe.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zoe.
What's your question?
How did the first person get their mother or father?
Very first person, Dr. Carl.
That's complicated, of course. And let me just warn you, at the age of seven, that everything is complicated. And it's to do with a process called evolution. And that takes us way, way back to about 3.8 thousand million years ago when we have the first living creatures on the planet. They're still around over in Western Australia in a place called Shark Bay. They're called stromatolites. And via this complicated process of evolution, a sort of accidental process, we turned from that into bigger bacteria, into fish, into fish with legs, into creatures that walked on the land, into dinosaurs, split into many different pathways, and then ended up with us. It's a big and complicated process.
And a long one.
It's a long one. It took billions of years. And by the way, dinosaurs are not dead. They're still around. They're called birds. And when you think about a bird, you look at it, it's got this, like a chicken, it's got this funny thing on its head, and it's got a beak. It doesn't even have teeth. And you think, wow. It's not like me at all. So dinosaurs are still around. So, gee, Zoe, that's a big question. I don't think I can answer that one. That's too hard. It'll take you a lot of reading to catch up with evolution and everything.
Does it make a little bit of sense to you, Zoe?
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, you can keep look up evolution, get mum and dad to help you with evolution, and that's a good place to start. Thanks so much for the call, Zoe.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Bye.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Oh, my God.
Oh, she's so sweet. Can we adopt her?
My heart actually
Let's
just
have
broke.
Her as the official Triple J mascot.
I don't know if Daniel can really follow this.
Oh,
Daniel, that is a hard act to follow. Calling in from Seville in Victoria. Are you with us, Daniel?
How you going?
Hi there, Dr. Daniel.
Not as cute as Zoe, I'm going to say. I'm going to call it. Sorry.
He's not as cute, yeah. You're more articulate, but you're not as cute.
But you may be able to understand Dr. Carl's answer a little bit better. What's your question?
Oh, look, I don't know if it's an easy one. It's why rainbows arched. I've got no idea.
Okay.
It confuses me.
Imagine that you're just standing out in the open and the sunlight is shining on the back of your head.
Right.
Okay, the sun is on the back of your head, not in front of you, it's behind you. And off to one, straight in front of you is this big black storm cloud covering the entire horizon from one side to the other, left, right, up, down. And at 42 degrees off to one side, so there's a line from the sun to your head. Yeah. And at 42 degrees off to your left, there's a lucky little raindrop floating in the air, held up there by the wind currents. And the light from the sun goes into that rainbow. Sorry, into that raindrop, it's bent a little bit, hits the back wall of the raindrop, is reflected, comes out through the front and lands in your eyeball and it gives you a red colour. You know, it's Isaac Newton, Dark Side of the Moon, prism. And the same thing happens for a raindrop 42 degrees above you and for 42 degrees to the right. And if you were standing on a long, very tall pin or a mountaintop, you also see the rainbow below you. You wouldn't have the horizon. And so that shape is a circle. Everything that's 42 degrees around you is a circle. You only see the rainbow as a half circle because the horizon gets in the way.
Okay, so if it was 41 degrees, it wouldn't work.
At 41 degrees, you get blue.
Okay.
Right. So go to Wikipedia, and they've got a lovely animation there.
Thanks so much for the call, Daniel.
Thank you, Dr. Daniel.
You are adorable as well. Don't worry.
Pretty adorable, but not as cute as Zoe.
Lucy's calling in from Canberra. Hey, Lucy.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
My question is, when you have a sudden shock, like when a car kind of swerves into your lane or you kind of start to fall off a chair but don't, and you get that kind of little pulse, that little shock in your body, what's actually happening to your body that makes you feel that way?
It's the famous sympathetic nervous system response that we've dealt with before. You don't run your body all the time because there's too much to run. You don't run your heart, you don't run your lungs, they run by themselves. And you've also got two systems, a sympathetic and a nervous system, and they sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. The parasympathetic nervous system, odd name, is for dealing with relaxing after you've had a meal. The sympathetic nervous system is for emergencies. And it, in medical school, you're taught that it deals with the four Fs, which are fight, fright, flight, and making love. And under the sympathetic nervous system response, you get the killer kangaroo coming around the corner, you fall out of bed in the middle of the night. A whole bunch of things happen that have been orchestrated. Your pupils open right up to let as much light in as possible. The blood supply to your muscles automatically is increased, so you're ready to fight and run. And adrenaline is manufactured by the adrenal glands, which are on top of your kidneys, so you're ready to fight. The blood supply to your skin is reduced, so you feel cold, but also you'll bleed less. And then if there's no emergency, you just start shaking afterwards because you haven't used up all that energy. So look up sympathetic nervous response or sympathetic nervous system response in Wikipedia and that'll give you the full story.
Hey, thanks so much for the call, Lucy.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you, we're going to stay on the adrenaline tip with Josh calling in from Maryborough in Queensland. Hey, Josh.
How's it going?
Very well. What's your question?
I'm just wondering if animals have an adrenaline gland, like if they get an adrenaline rush when they're doing certain things.
Yes, it comes from my favourite amino acid. My favourite organ is, of course, the uterus. My favourite amino acid, and there are 20 of them, is tyrosine. And
I didn't know that about you. Just learning.
Infinite surprises and depth.
Absolutely.
And so tyrosine gets turned into melanin and also adrenaline. And adrenaline means near the kidney. So on top of your kidneys are two little glands looking like little hats and they're called the adrenal glands and they make a chemical called adrenaline which comes from tyrosine. And traditionally you come around a corner and there is a big fat bear, and for a moment it's scared and you're scared, and if you look very carefully, suddenly the bear gets bigger. Mm-hmm. All of its hairs stand on end. Yep. Proof that it has the adrenal response, a sympathetic nervous system response.
Thanks so much for the call, Josh.
That's all right.
Thank
See you. See you later. Let's head to Albany in WA. Reese is on the phone. Hello, Reese.
How you going?
Great. What's your question?
My question is, when you're in the water for a long time, your hands and your feet go wrinkly, but the rest of your body stays normal.
I used to tell lies on this one.
Did you?
I was wrong. I admit I was wrong. I used to think wrongly, and I apologise for this in my 34th book, what I used to think was that on your hands and feet, which are work areas, where you're always touching the outside world, you build up, I thought wrongly, layers of keratin. There's keratin in your hair, keratin in your fingernails, keratin on calluses. Yeah. And this is like a soft, this is like an absorbent mesh. Water is absorbed and your fingers swell, and that makes your fingers wrinkly. And why doesn't it happen anywhere else other than your hands and your feet? Because they're not work areas, unless you're on a pilgrimage to somewhere and you're crawling on your belly several thousand kilometres, you won't get keratin on your belly. I was wrong, because what happens is your fingers don't swell, they shrink.
Mm.
And what happens is your sweat glands work backwards. And this was proved by somebody whose name I can't remember, but he's from the University of Singapore. And you put your hands into water and the water invaginates itself. Haven't used that word often.
That's a good word.
That's a good word. Pushes itself into the sweat glands and dilutes the saltiness of your body just inside the sweat gland. Your body responds to this as a threat, activates the sympathetic nervous system response, and you cut down the blood supply. So your fingers shrink. And then they go all ripply. So it's not your fingers swelling, they're shrinking, because water has got into the nervous system, into the sweat glands.
There you go. That's amazing. Thanks so much for the call, Reese.
No worries. Thank you.
Thank you for using the term invaginate, Dr. Carl. Let's go to Acacia Ridge, where Michael's on the phone. Hey, Michael.
Hi, how are you going?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
I eat quite a few eggs, and a friend of mine said there's a lot of cholesterol in eggs for consumption. Just wondering if it's too high, or should I be worried? Or is there something in eggs that actually takes away the cholesterol?
How many eggs do you have?
Oh, probably two or three a day.
Probably okay. It's a complicated answer. What I would recommend is that you go to the ABC Science homepage. So you go to abc.net.au and then ask the question eggs, cholesterol, and science, and you've got this fantastic explanation in the ABC Health. It'll probably take you 15 minutes to read it, and at the end of that time, you'll realise that you're okay. But it's good to get this knowledge, because some people say, oh, that'll take too long. Well, you can spend an hour and a half watching a football match, so you can spend 15 minutes looking on your body.
I think also with things like cholesterol, it's always very much related to your personal health. So maybe go and see a doctor and get a cholesterol check. That will help you out. People take in foods in different ways. It reacts in their body in different ways. Best of luck, Michael. Thanks for the call. And we're talking about whether intestinal transplants are possible, Carl. Leah is joining us on the line from Melbourne and says that you can do them. Hey, Leah.
How you going?
Good.
It's Lee.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, Lee.
Thank you very much. Okay. So tell us about them.
What do you know? Yeah.
So they are actually available overseas. In Australia, obviously, we're a bit more conservative with medicine than they are in some other countries, but they have actually been performed in Korea and in the States. It's they do multi-organ system transplants, obviously, so they can't do the entire digestive system, but they can do like your jejunum and duodenum and different parts of your esophagus and stuff.
That would take 12 hours.
It takes hours, and there is a massive risk of rupture, and it's very, very risky. It's a very dangerous surgery, and you're on anti-rejection drugs for the rest of your life, but it is actually possible. There are cases that have been done.
You'd have to do it for a very good reason.
It's generally people that are in intestinal distress, essentially. If things are failing, then they do it. If they're on TPN forever, which is through the vein feeding.
Wow, I had no idea that you could do a total...
So not in Australia, but in some places overseas.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, not in Australia.
Thanks so much for the call, Lee.
Thank you, Dr. Lee.
No worries.
Cheers. Let's head to Scoresby. Still sticking around in Victoria. Cameron's on the phone. Hey, Cameron.
G'day, guys. How are we?
Very well. What's your question?
That's good. Is there such thing as a human energy force field? And if so, are we mistaken as that as a god?
Number one, you can't have an energy field. A field has both intensity and direction. And so a magnetic field has a certain strength, you know, so many Gauss or milligauss or Teslas in a certain direction. Energy does not have direction. It's impossible to have an energy field. Secondly, it has never been found by science, only by people who believe in that hippy-dippy stuff that I used to believe in when I was a drug-crazed hippie, but not anymore. There's no. There could be something associated with the human body that is unknown to medical science and regular science today, but we've never found it because we don't know about it. It might be there, but there's zero proof as of today.
Thanks for the call, Cameron.
No worries.
See you later. Thank you. Will's calling in from the Sutherland Shire. I love this question. Hey, Will.
Hello. How's it going?
Very well. Hit us with your great question.
Yeah, so I was at a pretty awesome farm party on the weekend, and the question arose, will a beer go flatter quicker if it's held right in front of a really loud speaker?
Oh, wow. I was just listening to a podcast with Bob Heil, the guy who invented the 20,000-watt speaker system.
Wow.
And he ended up doing it firstly for the Grateful Dead, and then he got a phone call from some English band called The Who, who had turned up in Boston, and they had to fill a 15,000-seat arena with sound, and what they had was just some little speakers that they carried with them off the plane. And so he invented the 20,000-watt system. You get yourself a big, fat sound system. You can pretty well push the bubble. I had never thought of this, but yes, if you can aim them at the at your bottle of beer, you can get them out. Now, your typical champagne glass, and I mean real champagne from Epinay, as opposed to sparkling white wine, will, and by the way, according to Ruben, the surfing scientist, when you pour your champagne, tilt the glass. They teach you to not tilt the glass in bartender school. They are wrong. Tilt the glass. You get the glass tilted and you will get, out of one glass of champagne, 20 million bubbles.
20 million? That's a lot.
I know. It's amazing. So
no wonder you get drunker quicker on champagne.
Yeah.
So much air carrying it around.
There's the other, two glasses of champagne will get you as drunk as three glasses of champagne from which you have removed the bubbles.
Yeah,
the
right.
Bubbles get you drunker quicker. You got to know that one.
Science proving what I thought all
so
along.
So I'm reckoning that if you get some champagne and put in front of a big mofo sound system, and you're looking at, we're in the thousands of watts, I'm reckoning you should be able to put enough energy in there to shake the bubbles loose more quickly. And I want to see this as a YouTube video, as a video for next year's Sleek Geeks Eureka Awards. And we will give to high school and primary school students $10,000 worth of money and a free flight to Australia, to Sydney, at least, from inside Australia. If you can do this, that'd be because we give away this money every year.
Will, did you do the experiment at the farm party?
Well, the speakers might not have been quite loud enough. We had a big 1,000-watt sub. I was holding in front of it for a little while without actually thinking about it, but that's what kind of made me think about it.
Yeah, you have to do it with and without. So you need to video it with the sound and without the sound in a clear glass with proper lighting, same conditions, yada, yada, yada. You know where your thousands of dollars are coming from.
That's a great question. Thanks for the call, Will.
Awesome. Thank you.
We've also had a few texts come in from Dan from Melbourne, Amanda in Canberra, and also Tom in Melbourne, all saying, I heard that your skin goes wrinkly in water, so you have better grip underwater.
That's not because it goes there because the water goes in. An accidental evolutionary biology effect of it is, a result of it is, but that's not why. There's a difference between why it happens and the effects of what the wrinkling does. Yes, you can get rocks underwater and hold them better, smooth rocks, if your hands are wet.
There you go.
Yeah.
Let's have one more question. Ali, you are our lucky last caller, calling in from Gippsland. Good morning, Ali.
Oh, good morning. Hi, Dr. Carl. How are you?
Dr. Ali, we love you. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, if someone does a really big exhale, I guess, like quite a big, a large exhale, can that cause like a shocking or a tingling effect in your fingers?
Yes. If you do a whole bunch of them, in, out, hyperventilating, you can blow off from your body, from your lungs first and then into your body, so much carbon dioxide.
Right.
That you go into a condition called hypo, H-Y-P-O-capnia, C-A-P-N-I-A, and you can get tingling in your fingers. And if you do it enough, you can actually go unconscious. You see, the reason that you breathe is not because you are low in oxygen.
Okay.
Because you're high in carbon dioxide. Mm. So every Christmas, you get, or every time there's a swimming pool party, you get somebody who goes hyperventilates and tries to load up their body with oxygen, but they're really blowing off the carbon dioxide. They dive under the water. They have no desire to breathe because they've got no carbon dioxide. They don't breathe. They go unconscious and they die.
Heavy.
Wow.
Along the way, you get the tingling.
There you go.
So this blowing off your carbon dioxide gives a tingling because of the change in pH in your body.
Thanks so much for the call, Ali. Sorry, that's all the time we have this morning. Sorry for that. If you want to catch up on any of the Science Talk Back today, you can download the podcast. As I mentioned, it's totally free, triplej.net.au. Just click on podcast at the top of the page, or you can subscribe via iTunes. Dr. Carr, will I see you next week?
Oh, yes, please. I'd love to come back. I'm a bit manic at the moment because I didn't get enough sleep because I finished off my book. But yes, yeah, well.
Okay, see you then.